Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Good evening. I'm here with Ed Lee, who's the writer of a very interesting book, and we can get to that later. But Ed, you reached out to me after reading a newsletter that we put out at Crypto Slam. The content of the email was commercial rights for NFTs. And you're kind of somebody who's written a book on that. I will show that book here and we can talk more about that. Ed, glad to have you on the show. Thanks for coming on. Why don't you give a little background about yourself and how did you get to this point in your legal career where you're talking about AI, NFTs, and Web3?
Well, thank you first, Johan, for inviting me to this podcast. It's a pleasure to speak with you about NFTs, a topic that I think is near and dear to both of our hearts. In terms of my background, how I got interested in NFTs, the sort of long story that I'll try to make it somewhat short is my legal career has really tracked the development of the web. In 1999, I quit my lucrative firm job so I could start writing about the web. And at the time, Napster was the key controversy for copyright law. And I was fascinated by that case. And more generally, I'm just fascinated about disruptions created by new technology, especially the internet. So if you've tracked some of my academic writings, they follow the progression of the web, including user-generated content. I wrote initially about the Napster case. And then when NFTs entered the scene, and for me, it really hit home when Beeple's Every Days was auctioned for $69 million. That's when I really took notice. And the other ingredient that I would add to why I think, I was attracted to this development is that I started devoting a lot of time to becoming a photographer starting in 2016. And I spent a lot of time sort of learning the craft and got invited to a number of art shows and started, which was great. But then I started realizing the challenges that independent artists face, just how difficult it is to become successful financially, not in terms of like millions of dollars, but just to sustain yourself as an independent artist.
Right.
So when NFTs entered the scene, I had already been, trying to make it more sort of with recognition as a photographer. And that perspective, I think, gave me invaluable sort of insight into understanding why independent artists were flocking to NFTs. They saw what a lot of the people sort of in sort of the lay people maybe did not see initially when there was a lot of hype about it and a lot of criticism that they were just scams. But really, I think independent artists saw that this was a new way for them to sustain themselves financially. And I would say, especially for digital artists. And I think that that was one of the major utilities of NFTs is that NFTs created a new market that had not existed before for digital artworks. So what I referred to before, when Beeple's sale of $69 million for his digital artwork, that would have never occurred without the innovation of an NFT. So hopefully in that sort of long-winded answer gives you sort of the gist of how I became involved with NFTs and started researching it and how it led to the book.
That's actually, I didn't know that about you. So that is actually a very good perspective to have. I think artists trying to make it in the NFT space is one of the major reasons that they artists come into this space is to sustain themselves. We've talked to quite a few artists on this show about that. And I love that you do have that perspective. Let's talk about your legal perspective as well, too. Like, what is your legal training and how does that sort of tie in here?
Well, my specialty is intellectual property, and I focus predominantly on copyright, you know, talking about the Napster case. And obviously, copyright and artistic works or works of authorship, that's the primary subject matter that copyright regulates. And I think the theory that I developed with characterizing NFTs as a form of decentralized intellectual property is the kind of the innovation that NFTs can provide to intellectual property or especially copyright. The way that I analogize it to, you know, I think there's been more attention to DeFi as an approach, decentralized finance with cryptocurrency, and using that decentralized sort of sector to address some of the shortcomings of a financial system regulated by a centralized bank like the Federal Reserve. Okay. What NFTs have done with respect to works of authorship, including visual works and music and films, is to enable creators to tailor intellectual property in a way that's more flexible and beneficial to them. And this is actually how we met, because you wrote an article talking about how businesses and creators can use NFTs as a way to sort of better promote their intellectual property. And that was sort of an insight that I had started researching back in 2021, and that eventually led to the book. So, you know, my background, I think, in copyright law and intellectual property sort of made me more attuned to how these NFTs were being used and why, you know, to go back to what I said before, why a lot of the visual creators flocked to NFTs in the first place. They were not being adequately served by our current copyright system. So they saw that this new technology could enable them to better sustain themselves financially.
Yeah, I mean, I've read through parts of your book, and you can tell that you're a lover of the art scene. You do make a comparison between the rise of Cubism and how that affected artists, and the rise of this technology known as NFTs. I mean, one is an art style and one is an infrastructure, but I do get how you made that comparison. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, I would love to. I mean, I think one of the long forgotten histories is the development of modern art in the 20th century. And I think many people do not realize the negative reaction, backlash against modern art, starting with Picasso, one of the innovators and the co-creators of Cubism. And that lasted for at least 20 years in the United States, if not more. So people don't realize when modern artists were trying to innovate, they faced tremendous backlash. And even, I discuss this in the book, some of the top American physicians said these works were the product of mental illness. Yeah, and they were deranged. And, you know, unfortunately, the term that was often used for modern art in the beginning of the 20th century was degenerate art. It would lead to the degeneracy of society. And, you know, unfortunately, Nazi Germany picked up on that label and confiscated modern artworks, tens of thousands of artworks, to fund their effort in World War II. So to go back to what we can learn from the history of modern art is that when there is a disruption to the existing convention, it will often be confusing and even precipitate backlash. And I think when NFTs sort of exploded, there was this perception or narrative that they are scams, right? Mm-hmm. They are just scams. And there was one article that called it a crime against humanity, even. And I think that reaction runs parallel to the reaction of modern art in the beginning of the 20th century, because what NFTs did in the beginning was to topple the more conventional understanding of property and to create what I characterize as a form of virtual property or virtual ownership, where you do not need a physical embodiment of, let's say, an artwork. You could just simply have a virtual ownership of something that is recorded on blockchain. Now, that in the beginning may have seemed like a scam, but just a couple of weeks ago, Sotheby's had another auction for NFTs from the bankrupt 3AC collection, and over $2.5 million of NFTs were sold in that auction, which I think just further confirms this form of virtual ownership is real. So I think it's important for us, all of us, I would say in general, to study history to better understand radical transformations that occur in society. And the transformations of society in the beginning of the 20th century were just as disruptive and were just as radical as, we think about AI, for instance, today. AI is like this radical disruption. I think it is, no doubt. But just think when modern aviation was first developed, humans have been trying to fly for centuries. And then, the Wright brothers were the first successful to do so. And that led to the birth of aviation, when before it was just considered to be a pipe dream to fly. So, to put things in perspective, it's important to, study history, lest we are doomed to repeat it, right, as the saying goes. And I think what we're seeing now with the disruption caused by blockchain and also AI now is that there is this radical shift to the virtual. And I often, when I talk about this topic, I often engage an audience in a thought experiment. Just imagine, we are living in the year 2090. Do you think that world will be more analog or more virtual, right? Do you think the interactions will be more in the physical world, or do you imagine that there will be more interactions that will be assisted by technologies? Like, let me just give you a little preview, right? The Apple announcement coming out on June 5th, for their eyeglasses,
right?
Their Reality Pro. Do you think in 2090, we will see more technologies that are doing things like that? Or do you think we will be mainly with the 20th century technologies? Like, that would be the static way. And I think, most people would say they expect there will be these transformations to something that is more digital and virtual. And what we are seeing now with blockchain AI is an acceleration of this shift. And I think it started with the pandemic, when we were forced to be, virtual. We were really forced to do this. And, one of the byproducts of it is this, Zoom platform, for instance, is the perfect example of it, right? Zoom was not booming before the pandemic. And then suddenly we had to shift, and we shifted, right? And now it's a daily, I think, technology or tool that people use for business and for enjoyment.
That's That's quite the perspective. Thanks for that. Now I feel like you also want to mention AI, and we had a brief conversation prior to this meeting regarding the place of AI in the blockchain world. Now, that's something that people think that is mutually exclusive. One technology is mutually exclusive to the other. And maybe from an investor point of view, for a VC point of view, they're looking to put people companies into buckets. You're either a AI company or you're a blockchain company. And you and I pretty much came to the conclusion that they're both enabling technologies. And they are trying to enable something, and we just don't know what it is, but they're tools. And how do you see the explosion of AI, ChatGPT? Are those things just a fad? Are they just tools? Or are they just a new term to help investors create another tulip, like a bubble, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I think the key is in recognizing with NFTs, with blockchain, with now AI, ChatGPT, and other GPT-based tools, is I think we just need to ask, what is the utility, or what are the utilities provided by this particular technology? And for NFTs, I think clearly one main utility that has already been validated and proven over and over again is it establishes virtual ownership on blockchain. You don't need a physical, you know, embodiment to have ownership over a digital content, for example, digital artwork.
Now, ownership in terms of, yes, you control the wallet that has the NFT in there. You may not have the commercial rights to that particular image, but you do own the NFT. So there's the one thing that we can say NFTs do is that it provides the provenance. Where did the piece originate from? Where did it go to? I mean, we could have a fake NFT in a wallet that's of a real image, but it doesn't mean that it's the real image, nor does it mean that the commercial rights are assigned to the owner of that. So ownership is one thing, but then the provenance of how that NFT went into that wallet is, I think, probably the one thing that helps the art market, because the fakeries are always out there, right? So speak to the difference between that and ownership.
Yeah, entirely. I mean, I think you put your finger exactly on the way that it created this new art market with provenance. It's an authenticated token of whatever the artwork is. It, you know, could be a digital artwork, let's say a Tyler Hobbs Fidenza artwork. And having that unique token that is recorded on blockchain in itself, I argue, is a form of intellectual property. And you're exactly right. In terms of like the kind of traditional copyright uses that can be made of the artwork, that does need to be governed by a copyright license in addition to the token itself or NFT. So oftentimes there's at least an implied, if not explicit, right to be able to publicly display the artwork. Otherwise, I mean, what value of just having the token without being able to show it to people and say, here's the artwork that is associated with this token. So yes, provenance and having a unique intellectual property for this artwork is what establishes the market, right? Because just to expound on this a little bit, the reason why digital art did not sell before NFTs is that a digital copy can be infinitely reproduced. And if I sell my artwork, which exists only in digital form, that I cannot prevent anyone else, except through like bringing lawsuits, making copies for themselves and saying like, oh, okay, well, you know, the common, you know, phrase in the Web3 circle is, you know, you've just copied a JPEG or you just have right, a JPEG, right?
Yeah.
But we know that's not accurate, right? We know the NFT is unique, is different. And that is the problem that NFT solved, because now when Sotheby's auctions the NFT, it doesn't matter that other people can download the JPEG, because the JPEG is not the virtual, you know, property, the unique token. And I just want to return back to the previous question to tie this into AI and how I see NFTs and AI ChatGPT tools as complementary, as they are increasing this shift of many aspects of society to digital and virtual. So where I see ChatGPT as sort of running parallel to NFTs, both democratize creation or creativity in the sense that ChatGPT has opened up to a wider pool who can become visual creators. Because now, simply through text prompts, you know, anybody who has the ability to just type in some words can create something that's a visual image or visual, potentially artwork. And that will, I think, increase the creativity that people have using, you know, this awesome tool of AI and doing this kind of collaboration with AI and producing these kind of mind-blowing images and videos that you think, how did that even, it's like magic, how did that even become created with simply by using words? And then we're, you know, so now we've expanded the pool of creators out there. Some of them will become AI artists or digital artists who sell NFT. I mean, they already are doing this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some digital artists are already using Midjourney and other ChatGPT or GPT-based text-to-image generators, and they're launching a collection of NFTs. And, you know, I think that is just going to grow and develop further, especially as, you know, frankly, these ChatGPT platforms become better and better. You know, I mean, it just seems like every month, if not, you know, every few weeks, Midjourney has a new version. You know, it's the Midjourney 5.1 version. And, you know, then all of a sudden you see on social media, there's like, what are the advances of this new version of Midjourney or, you know, Stable Diffusion or, you know, whatever platform you use. The capabilities are just astounding and they keep on getting better and better. And, you know, once we've opened up these tools to potentially, you know, hundreds of millions of more people who were not visual creators before this, you know, we're entering a paradigm shift, right? In terms of creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think NFTs have a huge role to play in that. To give you one more example of this, the museums like MoMA, LACMA, Centre Pompidou that are actually acquiring NFTs, they're going to be, you know, pursuing to be on the cutting edge, right? So Rafik Anadol or some of the other leading AI artists or digital artists, you know, to have ownership. You know, they're going to expect ownership of the NFT, right? They're going to, that's what, to go back to what you said before, provenance, right?
Mm-hmm.
They want to know when they spend, how much ever they spend, you know, they have the ownership rights to it and not, you know, somebody else, because it can be easily duplicated. And I think that's how these technologies start intersecting. Now, obviously, there's not a complete overlap, but they're sort of complementary, especially in the creative sector.
I'm a big fan of the Thomas Crown Affair movie, And I remember that the guy in the movie, I think it was Pierce Brosnan.
Pierce Brosnan, yes.
He was an art thief, and he had a person who was a forger, and he had the best forger in the world. And up on his wall, he had, you know, this great painting. And this great painting in physical, it was an exact copy of the real one. And I don't know if it's just me, but I would prefer to know that I had the real digital one rather than have a real physical one that could possibly be a fake, even if it was well done. There's just something about knowing that it's the real thing. It's authentic, even if it is a different medium. So how do you think that other people feel that way or in the art world, or is it just about medium, like physical versus digital versus?
I mean, I think the art world has already agreed with you. I mean, I there are some firms that are already using NFTs as certificates of authenticity for physical canvases or physical artworks, that this comes along with the artwork, that they verify the provenance, you know, tracing it back in time. And I think you're exactly right. The technology is better than the analog technology. You know, one of the things that is an inherent problem with physical canvases or physical artworks is that the sales records over time, going back to, let's say, the beginning of the 20th century, you could go even further, but let's just even use modern art, artworks that go to their early, let's say, 20th century. How do you know that the sales records, the receipts, are actually real and not like forgeries, as you were suggesting from the Thomas Crown affair of the movie, which is a great movie, by the way. How do you know that those are, you know, like they're actual real ones and not somebody hasn't just doctored up some receipts to make it look like this traces back to, you know, the original painter? And, you know, this is one of the problems that the art world has always faced with. That's why there are, you know, authenticators who provide these certificates of authenticity or opinions that, you know, this is a true Picasso or true Matisse. But then, you know, you can read newspaper articles periodically where, you know, suddenly there's some doubt about the authenticity of a certain artwork. But you're exactly right. You know, the utility of the being able to look things up on blockchain and see, oh, well, now I trace back all these transactions, it goes back to the original artist. Yeah, yes, that's a foolproof way of trying to verify, especially the digital artwork where the file is, there's a link to it or is associated with the smart contract. It always becomes harder when the artwork is a physical artwork and there's a, you know, that's not on chain, so to speak. So there's always a chance that somebody slips in a forgery or a fake painting, let's say, even if there is a certificate of authenticity that is stored on blockchain.
There's a collection called the V1 Punks on Ethereum, which shows on-chain that they were deployed prior to the actual CryptoPunks collection, which was the quote-unquote official one. And I just find it cooler to say that I don't own one, but if I did, I would probably choose a V1 Punk just because of the fact that it was on-chain before the actual CryptoPunk collection, which then it probably has difference in terms of commercial rights. One, the company itself, which I feel like Yuga owns it now, they own the commercial rights to the punk images. They would assign the commercial rights to the official collection, but not the ones that are on chain prior. So that is a scenario that shows on chain that there's quite a few differences going on there. And it says to the community, where if you put that as your profile picture, you have certain values, like you either valuing commercial rights or you're valuing data provenance in that case. Now, switching the conversation to commercial rights, what can projects do to enforce that, even when people can just right click save your image? And also, what kind of rights are able to be imparted onto the holder of the NFT? Can we go into that discussion?
Sure, I'd love to. Briefly, I just have a brief comment about the CryptoPunks V1. I wrote a short article about that. It's a fascinating story because the reason why there was a V1 Punks in the first place and a V2, which is now considered the official one, is that there was a coding error in the smart contract that gave the Ethereum or the money back to the seller and not the gave it back to the buyer, gave the money back to the buyer. The buyer would pay for it and get the money back. So the fix that Larva Labs came up with was to issue a second round, basically, of CryptoPunks. But anyway, I digress. It's a fascinating story. Definitely very interesting. It was very early. It was in 2017 when they launched. So they didn't have it all worked out, as probably now projects have figured things out. But to go to the issue of what businesses, startup projects can do with NFTs and commercialization and enforcement, at least from the period that I've studied from 2021 to today, I would characterize the Web3 startup businesses that have PFP projects, so to speak. They've taken a more permissive approach to allowing clones and alternative versions of their NFT characters, such as the CryptoPunks. We'll use them as an example. There are so many copypasta versions of the CryptoPunks, right? And by and large, at least now, there's no attempt to assert copyright over those derivative versions that are unauthorized and probably in some cases would be copyright infringement. At the same time, and I think just to explain why that is so, I think the startup companies with a Web3 ethos see digital content as more differently than sort of how IP owners saw content in the 20th century, such as, let's say, Disney is the perfect example of a 20th century success story. And they very tightly guard Mickey Mouse and other copyrighted characters. CryptoPunks, Bored Apes, and others have taken, those projects have taken a more permissive approach. And we're not going to file a lawsuit for every unauthorized copy version of our apes or punks or you name it. Like, the successful ones typically generate some alternative versions that are more accessible in terms of price to consumers. But at the same time, the other ingredient that you asked about is the commercial rights with NFT projects. I did a study, and this study is coming out in an article later this year, of the top 25 NFT projects in terms of sales volume. The majority of them, over 60%, grant commercial IP rights to the owners of their NFTs, meaning the owners can take the character, their PFP character, monetize it, And many of them even create derivative works, a derivative version of it that's based on the original artwork, and keep the profits from their monetization efforts. Some projects put a cap on it at, let's say, $500,000 for Pudgy Penguins is the cap. Other projects like CryptoPunks and Bored Apes, there's no cap. So like the owner gets to keep all of the profits. And why this is significant is that in this business model, the project and the owners are collaborators in developing the brand or the IP. And I'll just go back to Disney to show what the significance of this is. It would be as if Disney Studio granted commercialization rights to people who bought, let's say, Mickey Mouse merchandise and could start monetizing Mickey Mouse. That just would never happen.
Right.
Never. That's a 20th century approach. So what we're seeing in just 2 to 3 years with some of these NFT startups is this more innovative approach to, bring into the project these investors who purchase NFTs. Now, I should drop as a footnote, we are sort of weathering the storm of the crypto winter. So a lot of the projects face, headwinds. And it remains to be seen whether this business model, how it will play out. The one that has the, most capital behind them is, Yuga Labs, as you referred to, $450 million in seed funding. So they have probably the most resources to try to make this work. And they certainly have the most commercialization by their owner so far. And the most famous example is Snoop Dogg, right? Snoop Dogg developed an ice cream brand, Dr. Bombay,
right,
around his Bored Ape character. I think it's still too early to tell how this innovative business model plays out, but it certainly is a dramatic change from the 20th century approach.
Yeah, it almost seems like this technology, going back to AI and blockchain, has enabled an explosion of brands. And the CCO license, which I talked about in the article, was used as a tool to proliferate the brand in order to gain market awareness and adoption within the market. So legacy brands, it was almost like there was not enough infrastructure for the regular creator to create a brand prior. And now these rails that have been built has caused this explosion of creativity. And now it's just a battle of which brand is more adopted. And I think these founders are using the technology and the community to gain brand acceptance and brand adoption.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great way to put it, is that the established brands maybe don't need to do this,
right,
or don't need to do it as much versus the startups that are starting from scratch, basically. And how do you get public recognition? Such as the Nouns. I mean, the Nouns is a fascinating project,
yep,
and CC0 abandoning copyright. And we're going to try to sort of make the Nouns characters just become much more accessible to people. And I'm a big Nouns supporter, or I like their project. And going back to what I just said a minute ago, the crypto winter is a challenging period for all of the projects, and I think if we didn't have the crypto winter, I suspect that some of these, you know, creative NFT projects would have found more success in these first 5 years, let's say. But there's a lot of carnage, so to speak, right now, with a more, I think, challenging economic time that maybe would not have, some businesses would not have sort of folded if we were in a different economic time, sort of from the macroeconomic perspective.
What makes a good brandable IP in your perspective? Something that's mass appealing, because we see a ton of creativity, right? Like, you can see, which frankly is crappy art, crappy PFPs, all the way up to ones that took a long time and a lot of thought to develop. And sometimes we don't know which ones are successful or which ones, there's no formula. The one thing that we do know is that community is a part of it. The art is a part of it. And the founder is a part of it. Do you have any favorites in the industry or in the NFT ecosystem?
Yeah, for the longest time, I felt that the Doodles project had the widest potential in terms of like mainstream recognition, sort of like a Disney, right? Like, these characters potentially could be popular with children, could be popular with adults. So that sort of brand and, you know, artwork, to me, had the widest potential. Now, I think they are facing some challenges. As I said, all these projects are facing challenges. So I would add into my answer is that the Pudgy Penguins look right now that at least as, you know, much potential, if not more. And what Luka Netz has done in resurrecting that project, you know, I commend him for a spectacular resurrection of that project. It seems incredible. And, you know, as you know, they just sold toys on Amazon and it sold out and et cetera. So yes, I mean, if we're thinking about brands that potentially could have the same sort of appeal as a Disney, then we want to hit children and we want to hit adults, right? We want to be something for everybody. Mm-hmm. And I see like Doodles and I see Pudgy Penguins as two that have the artwork that could be appealing across age groups. And also I think, you know, they have, you know, shown some promise already with the ability to attract collectors, the ability for Doodles. I mean, I would just say in terms of their in-person, the real events, I mean, South by Southwest, I wasn't at it. I looked at the video. I mean, it's like, terrific job. I mean, really incredible. But I think the challenge with PFP projects, and this goes back to your question, and you listed some of the factors that may be involved in terms of achieving success, is I'll go back to from my research, how Walt Disney succeeded. Disney succeeded because he and his brother as well, they had a story. They had stories to all of their short films and eventually all of their films. And that story resonated with people. Now, ironically, it resonated with people during the Great Depression. You know, so it was like bad economic times too, worse than now. And like, there was this huge success story of the Disney studio. And by the accounts that were contemporaneous at the time, what's the theories that were proposed to explain why was Disney so successful as a business was that they had a story that resonated with people. There was something funny about Mickey Mouse and other Disney characters. There was something lovable. There was something that identifiable across different age groups. Now, I would say of all the NFT projects, the closest that we have come to a project that having that similar kind of story, but at a different age level, are the Bored Apes. You know, tapping into the filthy crypto rich narrative that resonated with, you know, I think a pretty broad pool of the collectors of NFTs in 2021. I expect it still does today as well. You know, obviously, I don't think it the age group wise, I wouldn't say it's not targeting the age groups as broadly as, let's say, a Disney did. But that is, I think, a key that NFT projects need to figure out. What is the story that we can tell so that, you know, people will want to see, let's say it's a movie about doodles or a game involving doodles? I'm just using them as an example based on my answer to your question. And I'm not sure that, I'm not sure if the projects have really figured that out. The NFT projects have started sort of in reverse of what Disney did, like Disney movie. And then we're going to monetize through merchandise as well. NFT projects came out with like characters, and some, you know, have been engaged in representation by some of the top like Hollywood agencies. But, you know, we don't yet have a movie, let's say, you know, a motion picture based on these characters. So then the question becomes, if you don't develop a movie, how do you see mainstream adoption, which is the way that, you know, Disney was able to achieve sort of like global recognition today. But I think that's still left to be worked out, right?
I feel like the operators and the founders saw the opportunity to create their own IP, and they took that opportunity and they put it on chain. And there was almost like a FOMO to create that IP. Now, you talk about in your book this concept of decentralized IP or DIP. Can you explain that?
Sure. I mean, decentralized IP, I would analogize to decentralized finance. So DeFi is what probably many people, especially in the business sector, already know about. DeFi, what DeFi does with currency, you know, dollar or cryptocurrency, DIP tries to do with respect to copyright or intellectual property, meaning make it more decentralized. So not governed by, we don't have to wait till like the Copyright Office or Congress does something formally, like official action. We can, through private ordering and licensing and also NFTs, make intellectual property serve us better. And by us, I would say artists better, and also the public better. To tie this into what I said before about Web3, this ethos being more permissive, you know, I think there's a fair number of people among the public at large who don't think any single unauthorized use of content, like digital content especially, is infringement, like this downloading a JPEG kind of idea or whatever. So there, I think, is a greater expectation that there should be permissiveness, because all this is digital content, and, you know, we should be able to at least enjoy it more than having to license every single aspect of it. So DIP is a movement to use our existing copyright or intellectual property, but to tailor it to work better for the needs of artists and the needs of the public by bypassing, for instance, the gatekeepers, the industries. And that's very similar to DeFi, right? We're going to bypass the centralized bank and have things that are run sort of in a decentralized fashion, and have it, you know, sort of serve the artists better. And the one example that I point to that I think is a perfect example of this is that many artists chose to have resale royalties, or what are called creator royalties, for the resale of every NFT. They'll choose, let's say, 5% of the sales amount as the royalty they should receive. Now, 80 countries in the world have a comparable right under copyright. It originated in France, called the droit de suite. So for traditional visual artists who sell, let's say, a painting, if it's by a professional art dealer, like an auction house, then let's say 5% of the sale should go back to the artist or the artist's heirs. And that is because the copies of the artwork typically don't carry the value for an artist, like the original, like, you know, the one painting of Picasso, or if we're using an NFT, the unique NFT. That is the, going back to the provenance issue, that is the embodiment of the artwork that is unique on blockchain. And so, you know, if you listen to the top artists, from Tyler Hobbs and Ferocious and Claire Silver, and, you know, they all uniformly say, like, this was the key innovation about NFTs that attracted them, that helped artists. Because before this, at least in the United States, there was no such thing. So we can now change that through this technology and through contracts to receive 5% of every sale of an NFT. And that is an example of decentralized IP. If Congress doesn't pass it, you know, doesn't pass what 80 other countries have in the United States, you know, in the United States, what we can do is do it by contract and an NFT, and that will provide greater financial stability to artists.
How important is it for a project to specify rights and willingness of the purchaser to pay royalties on the mint versus on the secondary markets? The other thing is like, marketplaces can choose, and purchasers can now choose whether they want to pay royalties or not. But is there any legal way to enforce that at all?
Well, I mean, that's currently a what we would call a $64,000 question. That is one of the controversies with enforcement. You know, both Blur and OpenSea went down to for prior NFTs before 2022, or actually 2023, excuse me, went down to just a point, was it 5% minimum that for the royalty rate. That's all they're going to enforce for those prior NFTs. So yes, if we had to do this all over again and draft the smart contract and draft the IP license, it would all be integrated and baked into the smart contract and the copyright license or IP license. And there have been several attempts to create a smart contract that is self-enforcing and that stops circumvention or tries to stop circumvention of the payment of royalties. We'll have to wait and see if any of those efforts are successful. And yes, in terms of the copyright license, you do see now more, because this, you know, the circumvention has become an issue, you do now see more of the sort of new contract, copyright contracts or licenses specify as a condition in order to obtain the commercial rights to the artwork, you also agree, you know, that you will agree to the enforcement of the creator royalties.
Right.
Now, unfortunately, these issues were not worked out in 2021. And so we do have a, you know, set of the most successful NFT projects that were probably created in 2021. And the question is, how can they reconfigure their contract, or, you know, can the can there be other technological means to get enforcement of the royalties? You know, this issue sort of came at the worst time too, because in addition, there was just simply a drop in sales volumes, right? So it was, you know, kind of a double whammy. It was creator royalties can be circumvented by going to certain marketplaces, plus the crypto winter sort of caused a downturn in sales of NFTs. So in that environment, it's very difficult to expect a startup company to weather that storm, because what is their source of revenue if they have no creator royalties and the sales are down? I mean, they could think about launching another collection, but the problem with launching another collection is dilution of the original, right? The OG collection. So, you know, it's not surprising that at least some of the projects would not be able to weather this storm.
Now, that our discussion so far has been predicated on the fact that there are smart contracts, right? Now, and that was the Ethereum world. What we've been seeing in the last 3 months or so is a proliferation of NFTs or ordinals on Bitcoin, where there are no smart contracts on the layer one technology. So nothing's really enforceable in that way. Marketplaces, I guess, could choose what they want to show, but you can't really stop anybody from doing anything or changing a smart contract so that the NFT cannot be traded. The NFTs are more considered to be digital artifacts occupying a space on a global computer that has very limited storage space. So it's more of like a digital artifact. Now, how do you see this world? Have you been keeping up with it at all? I know I asked. I'm not sure if you have been observing what's happening on the ordinal side of things.
Just a little bit. I mean, it's a fascinating development. And I completed my book before this even started. And if I had to write the second edition and could revise, you know, some aspects of it, I was more pessimistic about Bitcoin blockchain as something that could give rise to the equivalent of an NFT in this ordinal. So it's definitely a fascinating innovation of Bitcoin blockchain. But I'm not, I guess I would say I'm not as expert in this area as more with the traditional, traditional might be too strong a word, the predominant Ethereum-based NFTs. One quick reaction I have to it, it seems to have, in addition to being on-chain and sort of having that as being distinctive, from prior Ethereum-based NFTs, I suspect that there is something about the competition between Bitcoin and Ether that the name itself, being a Bitcoin ordinal, might have a certain cachet that, let's say if I were a Bitcoin maximalist and I really thought nothing of NFTs as just like, NFTs are just playthings or something or whatever. I could see how I might be more inclined to take a look at the ordinals,
right?
And say, oh, wait a second. These are not, you know, these are not just playthings. The other reaction I have is that it does seem to present, you know, this kind of either the hybrid or something in between, where we have something that in between, let's say, the cryptocurrency and NFT. It's sort of like, okay, we can do something kind of in the middle that intertwines or blends some aspects of both. And, you know, that's when things, I think, in terms of sort of for those collectors or investors, it presents a new, I think, economics, set of economics to think about, right? Because I think with the PFP projects, we kind of have some understanding of those since they've been around for a few years, and, you know, rarity level and, you know, artwork, the does it vibe with you? Those are probably two important factors. I'm not sure if, and maybe you can give me your reaction to this. I'm not sure if the same set of factors would apply with Bitcoin ordinals.
Yeah, I mean, the way I see it is that, and somebody mentioned this yesterday on an interview, horses for courses, meaning the right use case for the right technology. And it seems like both Ether and Bitcoin can be used in different ways. It doesn't have to be one or the other. However, Ethereum, because you can, there's some immutability there with the smart contract versus Bitcoin, which there is no immutability. There are use cases for one or the other. For example, you would want to not, for something that you did not want to change, art, things that you'd want to upload to Bitcoin, then put it on Bitcoin. If there's something that you want to change, an NFT that you want to change, maybe it's a ticket or a license or a gaming item that becomes expired, then you would may want to use Ethereum for that. So there are the right technology for the right use case in that regard. So that's kind of the way I see it. And I do find that a lot of the people who were really concerned about scarcity and immutability are finding their way to Bitcoin, whereas the people who wanted to game more or create adaptable communities are staying on Ethereum. So that's the kind of what I've been seeing so far.
And the other thing, I mean, I have to say that it just shows you how quickly this sector can change, right? Yep. Since Bitcoin ordinals number two in terms of NFT volume, right, just occurred, and it sort of came out of nowhere, and within the past year really has gained traction. And you know, it's really hard to keep up with all of these developments.
Well, you can go to Crypto Slam if you want to keep up with these developments. Follow me on Twitter as well. Ed, it was a pleasure having you on. Where can people catch up with you? Like, where can we find you? Are you on Twitter? Your book is Here Again. And Yeah. Where can we find catch up with you?
Well, my book, first of all, Creators Take Control. I have a website. If you go to that website, I have my bio and information, Creators Take Control. I also tweet on New NFT, as that's a website that I write about NFT developments, newnft.com. So it's NOUNFT. .com for those interested. So that those two avenues would probably be the easiest way to find me. And I've really enjoyed our discussion. And thanks so much, Johan, for having me on. I'd be happy to come on at any other time.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We should do this again in a few months when things have more settled in and maybe we can discuss the legal aspect of ordinals. That would be fun. Thanks, Ed. A pleasure to have you on. Cheers. Have a great day.
Thank you so much. Take care.